we are back. Man, we were flirting with disaster today. We had a boat trip planned that didn't end up going like we wanted it to. But we will get into that in a little bit. Tonight's show brought to you by Predator Fly Gear. Check him out, predatorflygear.com. Go check out anything that Nick Mayer does, all Nick Mayer art. He has the best stuff.
Yeah, check out Ohlsdorf Genetic. Joel's doing a heck of a job, growing a lot more. Next year he'll be pumping hard with them.
Yeah, man. Those chicken birds, let me tell you what.
He'll be loading up.
Sims Fishing. Check them out, simsfishing.com. Get your waders, any gear you need.
Yep, go check out the guys over at Arex Hooks. Pretty much anything you can think of, they got it now.
And Yeti, Bill for the Wild.
Absolutely.
Man, we were listening to a podcast today. The plugs went on and on and on.
I think we literally listened to all the plugs, and as soon as they ended, I was like, can we listen to something different now?
Yeah, this I'm over it. But yeah, it was like seriously 12 minutes of plugs. I was like, oh, God.
Yeah, but the next one we listened to the rest of the day, and it was good.
Yeah, if anyone is interested, go check out Steven Rinella's The Meat Eater podcast.
Very, very good.
He loves him some dip, man.
Sure does. You were out here, I was out over the tails, dying a couple, and I think it was like a 20-minute conversation with the guest, and it just came right in, and they just, that's all that they talked about, is dip.
We are running a skeleton crew tonight, just Mark and myself, and my shop dog, Maui. She's sitting in Jay's seat.
Yeah, I'm about halfway here, so bear with me. I probably sound like crap on that end, but I'm stuffed up, plugged up. Just junk.
Yeah, man, it comes around, gets everyone. But we have a great guest coming on tonight.
Yeah,
Dave Huff. Do a little bit of Kentucky Muskie talk. I can't wait to hear about that stuff. Other than that, after Dave, we're gonna do a little bit of probably bucktail talk. Mark and I spent probably 9 hours today curing tails and dying tails and learning and find out what not to do and what to do. So we'll get into that. Now, even if we don't talk about it after, we're going to talk about it with Dave probably because he's venturing into the same processes that we're into.
Yeah, so our screwed up fishing trip today kind of benefited us. There's no way we'd had time to do all that.
Oh, no.
113 we did today?
Yeah, 113 tails. I was going to go hunting tomorrow. I bought my PA hunt license for the first time in 8 years. A guest from probably 3 or 4 weeks ago called me and said, hey, you want to go trout fishing with me and another dude? I said, that sounds like fun. So, and we're back with Dave Huff. What's going on, brother?
How's it going, guys?
Oh, we're doing awesome. Just nice. Coming down off of bucktail days.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm sitting in my basement, my man cave, and I got about 50... bucktails with borax covered them right now. So about another 250 in the freezer that my wife's eagerly trying to get me to get out of there. So I feel your pain.
That's a good start, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think we got 60 sitting with borax on them right now just from today, and then another 60 or so in the dryer waiting to get boraxed.
Man, I'm envious of the dryer setup. I have to I have to air dry everything. I don't have an extra dryer.
Oh, we went over to our buddy Jay's house and put him in an arm bar and stole his.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you should have seen the debacle just to get into the 220 plug.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very interesting smell. My wife, I can't even smell it anymore. My wife will come in and she'll be like, "You've been doing deer tails today, haven't you?" I'm like, "Yeah." Yep.
The first time I smelled it today, I was taking a big old whiff or a big old sip of High Life, and I had like 8 or 10 hairs on my hand and a big chunk of fat.
Yeah,
you do. You get that like warm meat smell.
Yeah, I've had a couple this year. Guys have been saving them for me, and a couple people like they'll like cut them off and they'll leave them in a bag on their front porch. And then they'll call me like a week after they did it. I'm like, oh, I left you some tails on my porch. I'm like, oh, they just been chilling on your porch for a week. Like those things might be a little sketchy, but so you never know what you're going to get when you open up that bag. But luckily it's been cold here. So
what's cold for you? 'Cause we have a story about being cold today.
Well, I mean, for me, by cold, I just meant cold enough to, like, keep the deer tails from being, like, rancid when you open the bag. So, like, below freezing or around freezing. But, yeah, not quite probably what you guys are used to up there.
Yeah, we went out musky fishing this morning and got to the lake, and it was pretty solid.
Oh, yeah? The lake was solid. That's a bad day.
Yeah, so we just ended up turning around coming home.
Yeah, that explains why you guys had deer tails to do all that.
So what's kind of your locale where you're at in Kentucky? Where are you located at there?
I'm actually in northern Kentucky, so I'm about 15 minutes from Cincinnati,
okay.
Ohio.
Yep.
I could, you know, 25 minutes from Indiana, so Tri-Cities there. But, yeah, it's just across the Mason-Dixon line, as they say, in Kentucky, so...
Cool.
So you're pretty much in a bourbon mecca.
Yeah, yeah. We're taught about bourbon at a young age, and if you buy Jack Daniels, you pretty much get disowned from the family here. Gotta be bourbon. Can't be whiskey.
So what you're
sorry to all the Canadian guys that like their Canadian whiskey, but.
So what do you typically fish there then? Lakes, rivers, kind of. What's the setup for you?
It kind of depends, man. We have a couple lake systems that are awesome, you know, pretty much impossible to get blown out. You just kind of have to know where to go check for fish. If you've gotten a lot of influx of water or if they're releasing a lot of water from the dams, they're all flood regulated, reservoirs. So, you know, you just kind of have to know if they're pulling hard, you got to kind of fish it like a massive flowage. And if it's not pulling, then you know, fish it like a lake. But then, I mean, we have tons of little creek systems that have really nice big fish in them too. You just got to kind of do some homework and figure out, you know, it's, I'm sure it's no different from where you guys are at. If there's big bodies of water that have fish, there's probably small bodies of water that touch those that might have fish in them too, if you look hard enough.
Well, that was going to be my next question to you is, You've been, from a previous conversation with you, you've been up in our neck of the woods before. Is your, like, creek systems, is that more like how, like, it is in Tennessee than it is here?
Yeah, yeah. So, like, yeah, I mean, the creek systems, you know, you can catch a 45-inch fish out of a creek that's 7 foot deep here, you know. Like, just be, it's lots of riffles and shoals, similar to how it is down in Tennessee. You know, this time of year, you get that real beautiful green water, and you just have, you know, tons of timber and cover to throw at. It's just, yeah, it's pretty cool, man. It's pretty rad to see some of the fish that come out of these smaller creeks. So
that would be a blast to do, though.
Yeah, yeah, it is. I mean, that, you know, they make you work for it, though. I mean, put ins are few and far between, and you know, hardly no public access. You gotta knock on doors and know where to go. So
that's what you got that FJ for, right?
Yeah, yeah. We got into some big fish on Friday, and it was a sketchy. I basically just drove through like 8 or 10 inches of mud right out onto a shoal, not knowing if I was going to be able to get my boat back out. But I was like, you know what? Supermoon, it's the moon that people just wait for all year for muskie fishing. And yeah, we ended up moving about 15 fish, and my buddy stuck one that was 47 or 48 inches on the fly, and got to go around in the 8 quite a few times. It was one of those things where he was like figure-eighting it, and like every time he'd come around, he'd speed up more and her tail would get faster. And after about the fourth time, I was like, okay, I'm just gonna grab the net because she's about to smoke that thing, you know. And then she ate it and tried to take off, and it was all he could do to hold the line from peeling out of his hands. So that was cool. You gotta work for it. It's no different than any other musky fishery. You could do everything perfect and not see one for months, and then all of a sudden you see 15 in one day, and hope that doesn't go away from too long. You know, you want to get consistent at doing that, but
Oh, and for
sure. I've heard stories of guys going for like 4 years without catching one, so I hope I never go on a 4 year drought. I might lose my mind.
So what are you running, a jet boat, or are you running a prop to the shoal with riffles that hop it out and pull it through?
I have a little like 1648 Sea Arc with a 50 horsepower Evinrude prop motor with an iPilot setup. So in the creeks, I typically don't even run the motor. I'll just leave the motor up and use the iPilot. And I mean that thing can really go through. The way I have it set up, it'll float through 6 inches of water. And I wear waders. If we have to push it through a shoal, we will. But for the most part, just try to stealth is the key. You know, I have a couple of buddies that have hog islands with jets and oars. And, yeah, I mean, jets are definitely the way to go. But going out on a lake, man, having that 50 horsepower motor on the back is nice because I think my boat tops out in low 30s or something. So it'll get across the lake pretty quick.
So you're talking Friday. You saw 15 fish. How many of them committed for you?
We moved. It was really gin clear water, which we were surprised because the flow was up a little. We probably had five eats. Right before my buddy Neil caught that fish, he lost a bigger fish on gear. It came out just, you know, classic musky scenario. Cast it to the bank near a log and, you know, work a lure, and fish just came out, smoked it, just turned just straight away from the boat and just started pulling his drag. And he has, I mean, he locks his drag out on those bait casters, and it was just making all kinds of racket. He's like, I can't even pull this thing in. And then, yeah, she got off, but for another day, I reckon.
So what water temps are you guys looking at down there, then?
The water temps were decent. They were probably 46 to 50.
All right. Yeah, you're good.
I didn't check. I actually run I run my transducer and stuff on the inside of my hull, so it doesn't do water temperature. And I didn't throw a thermometer in. I mean, we didn't even have electronics on because it was such a small creek. You know, you kind of just, you know where they're at and where they aren't in those little systems. But yeah, if I had to guess, just based off of how quickly I cooled down, putting the boat in and getting it out, it was probably mid-40s. It definitely wasn't over 50. So,
how's that hull through transducer working for you? You like it?
Yeah, I got a Garmin Striker SV. The transducer is like the perfect size to fit down in the little V of the hull. So it kind of sits down in there, and then I have some stuff that I set on top of it so it doesn't move around. Sometimes out on the lake I'll have to take like a couple bottles of water and dump it back there just to make sure there's connectivity between if there's any air at all between the transducer and the hull. It kind of just connects it, but I mean, yeah, it picks up fish great. I mean, depth's great. And I didn't want to hang it off the back. Those things are so big and expensive that, I mean, I've seen too many guys just break them off, you know, in the creeks. So
that's the first thing I said today as I drove mine through the ice. Oh, yeah. My transducer.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, I mean, they break easy. The little mounts that they make for them are nuts. I know that there's some stuff out now, like some bigger, like aluminum ones and stuff that look pretty good, but yeah, so far I've been happy with just running it through the inside. I haven't had to drill a hole in my transom, so that's cool.
Well, speaking of that, I'm going to do a shameless plug, because on the front of mine, I run a 7-inch side view, down view, and I have one of them transducer shield and savers, the aluminum one that locks onto it. That thing's worth its weight in gold. I have smashed that thing off, and I can't tell you how many rocks and sand and everything. It hasn't even got to the transducer.
Really?
It protects it, really. I mean, they're not bad. I mean, you figure, that what's a transducer? A few $100 for 80, 90, $100 to protect it. It's well worth the investment.
Yeah, that sounds like a good deal. I if I ever, I always toy with the idea of getting a new boat because my boat's called Flat Bottom Betty, and she's been road hard and put away wet. The guy that had it before me was a bow fisherman, so it's got lots of character. You know, it's one of those boats. It doesn't look like much, but it gets slimy, and that's all I really want out of it. So it starts up every time. So hasn't left me stranded yet.
So with a boat coming from a bow fisherman, are there any modifications that you just couldn't figure out what he did? Suited the bow fisherman.
He had it decked out perfect. I mean, almost anywhere where it could be flat deck with no like hang ups, it was already done. It didn't have any like the side rails or anything. So it was honestly like once I saw it, I was like, man, this is like perfect for fly fishing. Like there's really nothing to get hung up on. The only thing I did was I put a Garmin Striker SB7 on there and I put an iPilot trolling motor on it. It had a foot controlled motor on the front. Other than that, man, it's been awesome. I'm going to redeck it this winter because the water's starting, the waterlogged deck's getting a little heavy. So time to update that. But yeah, I mean, big flat surface, you know, and he honestly had it perfect because it's like, it's inset about 4 inches from the top of the deck. So the fly line won't blow in the water or anything. I mean, yeah, I couldn't ask for a better setup. So
that's perfect. What are they chasing bow fishing wise? They shooting carp or they shooting gar?
I don't know because I bought it from a guy down in Tennessee.
Oh, okay.
If I had to guess, I would probably say carp and gar. All the above down there.
Do you ever run into a gar as bycatch?
Yeah.
While you're muskie fishing.
You know, we were talking about that yesterday. This stretch of river, I've actually seen quite a few gar. And it always seems like in the summertime, wherever there's muskie, there's gar. At least down here. So,
what kind of gar do you have?
We just have long nose gar. Yeah, we don't have any like the real big alligator gars down here, really. Not that I've seen, at least.
What size do yours get to?
Down here is like 48 inches is a decent size one.
That's pretty good.
That's a big gar.
That's decent.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're not small. I mean, there's, you know, you have a handful of the 26 to 30-inch ones, too. But, yeah, every once in a while, it depends on how close you get to the Ohio River. The closer you get to the mouths of these things, the bigger the gar get. And I know there's guys that have caught some massive ones, but typically the ones we see in the creeks are, you know, between 36 and 48.
So, can you tell us how you got into the muskie fly fishing game?
Yeah, I actually was, I've been fly fishing. I grew up fishing my whole life. I mean, I learned from my grandpa, like, lived in the country, just, you know, typical outdoorsman kind of, you know, farm pond fishing, creek fishing, and, I bought a fly rod maybe 7 years ago, and I didn't really know anything about it for a couple of years. And then I went down to Asheville or Brevard, North Carolina, and wanted to learn how to fly fish. And I went with a guide out of the Davidson River Outfitters shop. And that was maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And he just kind of taught me the ropes, caught a bunch of trout, brown trout, you know, rainbow trout, brook trout. Just started getting into it and then slowly just wanted to learn more about it. I'm a pretty inquisitive dude anyways. I like to, when I get hooked on something, I like to learn. And I just started learning about other species and I had made a post on, like, I belong to a fly club back here, the Northern Kentucky Fly Fishers. They're pretty big, active club. I made a post about one of my trips with some of the trout that I was catching, and there was actually a dude that, like, reached out to me on private message and was like, hey, if you ever want to try to, you know, fly fish for muskie, I'm always looking for people to go, you know. It's hard to find people, and I was like, like, yeah, man, I own my own business, so my schedule's pretty flexible. I'd be down to try it. I don't know anything about it, you know, but I'll give it a shot. And, yeah, that's kind of how it started. So did that for a while. And after probably, like, 4 months of that, I was like, man, I need to, you know, I was borrowing his setup and decided to get my own stuff and bought some flies. And that's when I met Sully from, you know, the original Urban Fly Dude. And, yeah, just kind of, from there, you know how you, the same story that probably every other person that has any drive at all, once they start catching muskie, they're like, oh, this is not good, you know? So I really haven't been trout fishing for a while. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think for the first time you see that head coming and it's just, it's done from there. But
yeah. Yeah, it's a different experience. And, I mean, it's not for everybody. I mean, some people really want to just catch, you know, stocker trouts and catch 30 or 50 of them and have a good day doing it. And, I'd rather go out and beat my head against the side of a boat for 2 or 3 days and see 2 fish and maybe one of them would eat something, you know?
So what point did the tie-in kick in on your end then?
I have an FJ Cruiser that's like set up with like a rooftop tent and the whole deal for doing, we do a lot of long trips and try to camp as much as we can. And, we did a summer trip last year to, Ontario and Ottawa. And, I ended up meeting up with Sully while we were there. And I had talked to him quite a few times, like telling him like, man, I'd really like to learn, but I just, you know, and, while we were there, one day we got out, like, I think we were eating lunch or something, and he went to his truck and pulled out this tote, and it had, like, a bunch of tying materials and his vise. He's like, I'm going to show you some pointers. And I'm like, holy shit, this is about to happen, you know? Like,
shit's going down.
About to learn how to fly tie, you know? It's, yeah, like, so the first fly that I ever tied on a vise was a muskie fly. I still have never to this day tied a midge, and I probably never will. So, yeah, man, it was a cool experience. I got to do that, and then probably spent thousands and thousands of dollars on bucktails and vices and tools and you name it, you know. No, anyone that ties knows how it's just another form of the muskie sickness, so...
It is. It's a way to keep your head in the game while you're not actually musky fishing.
Yeah, I mean, my head wasn't in the game this past Friday. I was just having one of those days where I could have, you know, I couldn't do anything right, you know. I knew that I was not going to connect with a fish, you know. I was just, yeah, it's just one of those things. And I was like, man, I need to go back to the vise and do a little tie-in, reset a little, you know. My box was getting a little bit bland, and I'd given out quite a few flies to some people, and I just need to restock. So I think maybe tomorrow's my birthday. Maybe I'm going to sit down and tie a couple flies up. Who knows?
Well, happy early birthday.
Happy birthday.
Yeah.
What style of fly do you like? Do you like the Buford head like Sully ties or changers or T-bones?
I really like the Buford head. I've been tying up some game changer style stuff, you know, with 5 or 6 shanks and just working on sparseness and getting that side to side walk and still having the Buford head. I love the way Buford heads work in the water. So I've been doing a fair amount of shank work lately. But man, nothing beats a good Buford single, especially in these creeks, you know. They just, you get the right hackle and stuff in there, and they just get smoked. They don't typically, the game changers, I've noticed the fish kind of follow them, and they're like, what is that? You know, if they're too big for the creeks. But those little singles, man, it seems like this fish come in mad at them. to just eat them. So
when you're saying little singles, what are you talking about? Like 6 to 8 inches?
Yeah, six to eight inches. You know, usually I usually use the Arenex Predator hooks, the new Trout Predator 6.0s, what I've been liking a lot. Just one of those has been pretty good.
Yeah, they're nasty hooks.
Yeah, they are. It's amazing how many times you'll stick yourself in the thumb with one. But yeah, they're the 6 to 8 inch Bufords, man, and they've caught a lot of fish, so for good reason, you know. But you can never beat a big game changer the way those things look in the water. It's just I throw the game changers a lot more in the lake when we go to the lakes.
Do you have you noticed that the fish act different from a lake to a river system?
Yeah, they definitely. It really is. It's weird. Depending on which lakes we go to here, the fish act so much differently in each body of water. You know, one lake you might just know that they're always going to be out at the points in the coves, and then another lake they're like all the way in the very very back of a cove in like 4 feet of water. You're like, why are you in here? You know, it just it's a you just have to learn. You know, most of our lakes are I think 2,500 to 3,000 acres, so they're bigger lakes. So it takes a while to learn them and figure out where the fish are going to be. And like I said, a lot of it depends on what the lake's drawing and obviously the weather. Between the moon phase and the weather, it's a crapshoot sometimes. But I do feel like the lake fish seem to lurk a little bit more. The river system fish seem to just, if they see something and they want it, they just come out of nowhere and just crush it, you know. But you get a lot more follows on the lake, and they'll come in real low and just kind of hang out under the boat for a while. So, yeah, there's a little bit of a difference. I think the river fish are just less timid. I think they're a little more aggressive.
They got to react faster, though, also because their bait's moving with the current or their forage.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, they kind of come out from under the little hiding spot and, you know, take one swing at it. And although I did have Friday, we had a fish that ate, rolled over, was hooked, and came unpinned. And then the very next cast came back, and it came right back and ate it again, which is rare. I've never seen that happen. Because I mean, it was definitely stuck. It wasn't, you know, it was on for 5 seconds or something, and then got off. So.
To have
that same fish come right back and eat again, I was like, dang on, that thing wanted it. So
what do you think is going through that fish's mind when it's pinned and then comes back after the fly? Do you think he thinks it just got a bluegill stinger in its mouth? Or?
Yeah, I mean, that's all I could imagine. I mean, they get that, or, you know, sometimes if you're quick enough, you know, that's the good thing about some of these small creeks is they're so small you can get a cast out so fast again that they might just still be so amped up from eating it, you know, and their adrenaline's still going that they see it again and they just want to kill it this time, you know.
So, they're pissed off at it.
Yeah, just pissed that, you know, like what else is going to mess with them, you know? So, but yeah, I think about that a lot. I'm like, what do they think these things are when they come up and swallow it? Their gills flare out, they suck a fly in their mouth, and then all of a sudden it's instant, like, what is this, you know? But I'm sure, I mean, there's a lot of crappie, there's a lot of bluegill. I'm sure that those fish have encountered something pointy like that, you know, if they've ever had to, like, wrestle with a gar or anything. I'd imagine that something has to poke the inside of their mouth. You know, they just stop eating flies altogether eventually if they got hit to it. But I don't know, man. They're predators. They do whatever the hell they want.
You were talking about the big one coming up in the eight. Did it?
Yeah.
Did it eat on the turn or on the fast straightaway?
You know, he ate right at the boat, coming back to the boat, not on the turn, which is not normal. Usually they turn when you're turning away from the boat is when they'll smoke it. And she finally, you know, he turned towards the boat and took off, you know, up the side of the boat, and she ate it right by the boat, which is, like, in my opinion, that's like the hardest strip set to you know, pull out right there.
Yeah, for sure.
Man, it was, yeah. Her gills flared out, and that fly disappeared, and it was game time.
So how does your gear setup change when you go from river to lake? Are you throwing essentially the same rod line setup, or are you switching it up a bit?
I've been testing out a 12 weight blank that I've been that I'm going to release here soon. So I've been throwing a 12 weight a lot lately with the 500 grain air float that finder line, but I like to throw a 10 weight in the creek if I can, because you don't really have to have that distance. But I think I've really been enjoying this 12 weight, so I may just keep it and just throw it all the time with the 500. I put 500 on the 10 and the 12. I could probably get away with like a 400 or 450 on the 10. It would be better, but I really like that. I like how the 500 sinks. So, especially if it's any current at all, you know.
What is the inch per second on the airflows?
Oh man, I want to say it's like 7 or 8.
Yeah, get down.
Yeah, it might be more than that. I don't remember exactly what it is. I'd have to look it up. I'm not super picky about gear either. I mean, if it works and it casts, I'll try it out. So,
well, that's a perfect segue.
Yeah.
What do we? You said you got a rod you're going to be releasing, and you want to touch on the rod company a little bit.
Yeah. So I started a company last. I guess in summer of 2017 is when I actually formed the business and formed the relationship with the distributor. And I launched the website in January of 2018. Wolf Rod Company is the name of the company. It's WHUFF. It's basically my middle initial and my last name. I mean, basically wanted to form a company to get some high, like, good quality product out to people that are getting interested in fly fishing without breaking the bank. It's a blue collar worker kind of business model. I had a ton of I went to school for industrial design, so product design and R&D engineering was what I did for 8 or 10 years, so I had a pretty good background in product development. And found some suppliers overseas, and yeah, just basically spec stuff out and have them make it and send it to me. I haven't really pushed it too much because I've still been in the R&D process, going on 18 months of R&D, just to kind of make sure that everything that I offer is something that I'd put my name behind. So. I'm going to start pushing it a little harder next year. We're going to release a 10 weight muskie series called the River Wolf that will retail for $179. And that'll come with an extra tip. And then, yeah, the 12 weight, that's going to be knocking on the door too. I don't know exactly what the release date's going to be on it yet, but, same price point. Try to keep everything on my site under $200. And you know, some of the OEM stuff that is not custom to me is cheaper. You know, you can go on there and get a fly rod for under $100, and it's you know, I've had guys take their 8 weight rod that they spent $80 or $90 and go down and redfish it all week in Florida and just come back and be like, I can't believe how good this thing casts. So, yeah, I'm excited about it. I like product design. I like being able to put some quality product in some guys' hands. You know, we have I mentioned the fly club that I belong to, and we're getting a lot more younger members every month, which is cool coming to the meetings. But we weren't we're having bad retention on some of them because they would kind of show up and then they'd go start looking at fly rod prices and they'd be like, you know, $800 for a rod and reel, and they were kind of like, I'll just stick to my spinning gear. And that's kind of what kind of pushed me to try to see if there is another option out there, because a lot of this stuff is, you know, marketing and branding's a huge portion of the cost associated with some of the stuff. So, you know, I try to keep my overhead low and do right by getting some people out on the water. And then if people want to, you know, people want to buy something from my site and get into the sport and then go out and spend $1,000 on a, you know, top of the line, like really awesome, like, you know, company's product, like, hey, just got somebody else into the sport of fly fishing. So I'm cool with it.
Like you said, a Helios for a college kid's a year's worth of beer money.
Yeah. You know? That's a lot of dollar beer nights at the bar on Friday, you know?
Yeah.
Dude, I've been seeing a lot, I guess, starting off recently with the extra tips. So if you break a tip, can someone just call you right back and order another tip then?
Yeah, my my plan is to try to, I'm going to start stocking extra ones. All of my custom stuff will have one with it. But yeah, I think that's where I'm heading. I'm not currently there as far as having a bunch of extra tips in stock because, honestly, I haven't really pushed a lot of sales, so I don't have a lot of product out in retail customers' hands. I've got $5,000 or $6,000 just in R&D product out in people's hands that they've been fishing trying to break, you know. So luckily no one except for me has broke one, and I broke mine loading my boat. So the old tip broke off, you know, just trying to shove it down in a rod storage area. So that was my fault. It was, you know, 10 degrees that day too, so.
It's better than a typical ceiling fan story.
Yeah, or, you know, I shut my car door on it or whatever.
Oh, garage doors are infamous.
Yeah. I mean, I basically just took my hook cutters and cut it back to the, you know, whatever guy that broke off at and filed it and fished it that day. It was all good.
I mean, 8'6" shorty.
Yeah. My 12-weight, 8'6" rod that casts like a lightning bolt now.
So Mitt, the majority of the rods that you're going to be selling are going to be musky equipment?
No, I sell, actually, I have some fiberglass stuff on there. Full range of stuff. Actually, one of the most popular rods that I've sold locally has been a 10-foot, 3-weight nymphing rod. People down here seem to really enjoy it. There's a creek not far from us. Well, I shouldn't say it's not far. It's 3 hours from us, but it's a place called Hatchery Creek, and it's a man-made trout stream that connects the Cumberland Trout Hatchery to the Cumberland River. It's like a mile and a half long, and it was all constructed with heavy equipment and purposely built for trout streams. And I mean, it's a world-class stream at this point. There's my buddy Brad just caught a 25-inch, 16-inch girth brown trout out of there. So the Cumberland River is starting to produce some really, really big fish. And people love nymph fishing that because it's not real wide, and they've been liking the, like, Euro nymph style. So those 10-foot rods are awesome for that.
You know, I've watched a couple videos and read on that, and I am by no means going to indulge my opinion on it. But was there originally trout non-stocked, you know, native wild fish in the Cumberland River before?
I think that depends on who you ask.
I guess basis off of the state. Is the state saying in their regulation books that there is wild fish in the Cumberland?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
But that, you know, the Cumberland goes all the way down into Tennessee. So, I've read that there were native fish in there. I don't know how many are still in there, but, you know, basically what they did was the hatchery there and the river, it was just kind of like a ditch that connected the two. It wasn't, I mean, it was terrible to look at. It was an erosion problem. So they needed to fix the problem from the outflow of the hatchery to the river anyways. So they just decided to make it like a world-class, you know, trout fishery, a destination for people to come to, and it's worked. I mean, there's people down there all the time, you know. And they got a big put-and-take section at the very top where the fish come out of the hatchery, and then there's a waterfall, and then from the waterfall on, it's, you know, all catch and release. But, I mean, they've made some amazing habitat. And, I mean, it's not uncommon to go down there and catch multiple 20-inch rainbow trout in a day. I mean, they're stacked up in that thing now. And the river's amazing, too. It's got some monster brown trout and rainbows in it.
Yeah, the Drake did a whole podcast about Hatchery Creek.
Yeah, yep.
So, if anyone wants a little bit more info on trout weenie stuff.
Yeah,
we'll direct them that way.
Yeah, there they go.
But I seen Euro nymphing like the guys that do Great Lakes Steelhead. I didn't picture Kentucky to be a mecca of Euro nymphing.
Yeah, I mean, it really wasn't until that creek was built, you know. But the way it was built and constructed and the width of it, it's like the perfect type of fishing for it because they got these weed beds that come out a few feet from the bank. You don't stand in the water at Hatcher Creek. You can almost fish from the bank there. It's got tons of logs and things and rocks or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, you can practically reach the other side of the stream with a Euro-nymphing setup. So, yeah, I mean, I think before that creek was built, Euro-nymphing probably wasn't a thing in Kentucky.
So have you ever Euro-nymphed?
I have not. It's funny that you asked that because a buddy of mine was just talking about doing a steelhead trip. And, I was like, I've never fished for steelhead. And he's like, really? I'm like, yeah. He's like, they're awesome. I'm like, yeah, but I can drive like an hour away and catch a 48-inch muskie, or I can drive 4 hours away and then I have to nymph fish for a steelhead.
Yeah, stare at a bobber all day.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm like, I think I'd be happy to try it, but not now. Like, I'd rather do it, like, in, like, November or, like, the spring when I can swing streamers, you know? Like, I'm not trying to, like, drift an egg pattern in, like, 0-degree temperature for hours on end to catch a couple fish.
That's perfect for after, like, 30 years of musky fishing and the rotator cuff surgeries and the tendonitis get to you.
Yeah.
Gives you an alternative.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they look amazing. The fight is super enticing to me. I would love to be able to catch a fish that takes me to the backing, you know. Some of the stories I hear from my buddies, like, about how they had to start their boat up and, like, chase down a big fish, like, that's pretty cool. But like I said, I mean, we just don't have any steelhead water in Kentucky, and the closest place is like 4 hours from here. So, I mean, I got musky water that I can, you know, fish within 1, 2, or 3 hours of me that has, you know, native populations of big fish. So, and unfortunately, steelhead season and muskie season kind of overlap. So,
what about stripers? You guys got the upper Cumberland, the actual lake has them too, correct?
Oh yeah, yeah. When I've been out on the Cumberland River and seen huge pods of striper. Striper are real big there. They're that's another fish that I haven't really ever targeted though. I just never had the right setup and, like, didn't have a boat at the time. And, yeah, it wasn't something that Yeah, I mean, pretty much once I started catching muskies, I was like, okay, this is pretty sweet, you know?
You just put the blinders on to everything else.
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, I still enjoy going out fishing, and there's some local streams. I like doing the fishing derbies with the fly club, and, you know, teaching, you know, every once in a while someone will be like, I'm getting ready to go on this trip to Montana, I've never cast anything, you know, and I'll meet them out at a park and teach them how to cast a fly rod into a pond. And, you know, I still like to do all that kind of stuff, 5 weight, 6 weight, 8 weight, whatever. But my passion's in the big fish, man. They're just so cool to watch come up to your boat, whether they eat or not. I mean, it's just not a lot of, there's just not a lot of fish that will just completely blow your mind, you know? Like, I have a funny story. Someone the other day was asking me, like, what's the appealing part of muskie? Like, well, here's a story. Like, so the last big fish that I caught on the fly, my buddy was with me. He was throwing gear. I was throwing fly. I had this fish that come out of nowhere. I think it was a 42, 43 inch fish. Comes out of nowhere, follows my fly around in the eight a couple times. And then, you know, as I was turning away from the boat, it just decided to, you know, eat my fly, strip set perfect, catch it, land it. My buddy was pumped because he netted this fish for me, got some pictures, put it back in the water. You know, we're fishing. About 45 minutes later, we get another follow, and it was him this time. He got a follow. I'm like looking around my boat. I'm like, where's my net? Like, my net's gone. Like, what happened? And he's like, oh, I think I know where it is, you know? I'm like, dude, did you throw my net in the creek? He's like, maybe. so we float back down to where I had caught that fish, and he puts on this real, like, heavy, like, angry dragon, like, gear, you know, lure or whatever, and throws it out in the water and pulls my net up first cast, pulls it up. So I'm just like, there's really no other fish that could get the other guy that didn't catch the fish so pumped up that he just nets your fish and then throws the net in the water, you know? And then, you know, we fished for 45 minutes before we even realized that he did it. So yeah, I mean, I've never thrown my trout net in the stream or anything after catching a fish, but that's pretty funny. So
you caught a pretty unique fish the other day. Had an eye that was a little goofed up.
Oh yeah, that was actually the fish that my buddy threw the net in at.
Oh, did he whack it in the head with a net and googly its eye?
No, both of its eyes were, you know, that fish, both of its eyes were, like, bugged out of its head like that. And, yeah, it was the craziest thing. The water was kind of dirty that day. You only had maybe, like, a foot or 2 feet of visibility. And, man, she came out of nowhere and just came up behind my fly and had those crazy eyes, and it was so hard to stay concentrated on figure eighting, you know. I'm like talking to my buddy. I'm like, dude, what's wrong with her eyes? He's like, keep figure eighting, you know. He's like, pet talking me. I'm like, what's wrong with her, you know? But I don't know. I think the consensus was that she had some kind of a brain tumor and she was probably blind, but. Yeah, she ate a game changer. She could feel that thing in the water enough to follow it around the eight like three times before she ate it. So, yeah, and she was fat. Crazy. She was healthy. She just probably couldn't see. So,
yeah,
she probably stays in that one little hole in that creek all the time, you know?
So how many of your friends quoted Arnold Schwarzenegger? It's not a tumor.
Honestly, I didn't get a whole lot of that. I was kind of bummed about that. I figured that I'd get all kinds of tumor quotes and memes and whatever, but people were just like, that thing's crazy looking. So, but I guess I have unoriginal friends. I don't know.
Yeah, I think for the listeners out there that haven't seen it, kind of looks like the guy from all the Adam Sandler movies. I forget his name.
Oh, yeah, Steve Buscemi?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Old crazy eyes.
Well, now do you reach a point in the summer times where you know, you get 80 plus optimum, you know, where temps where you got shut down?
Yeah, there's definitely some spots that we absolutely can't fish. There's a few places down in southern Kentucky though that are like spring fed, and man, I hate to even get started on the it's too hot to fish. You know, it depends on who you ask. There's guys that have been fishing muskies for their entire lives down here that will swear up and down that southern strain muskies are like completely okay to catch as long as you don't pull them out of the water and, you know, stress them out and do all that.
I tell you what, though, there might be something.
Guys are deer guys, though, most of them. Bringing one in on a fly takes a lot more than some of those gear guys, dude. They hook them in there in the net in like 5 seconds, you know? Like, that is not the case with a fly. I mean, I've had a few that have happened like that, but usually you got a minute and a half, and that stresses them out when it's cold. So, you know, in the summertime, I don't even mess with it. There's only a few spots that I know that the water temps stay cool because, you know, there's some underground streams rolling in or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, this year was really bad. It got hot for a while.
You got to put some screws in that rod.
Yeah, yeah.
Man, what was I going to say? That you got me off track there. Dang it. I had a question for you, and then you started talking about how long it took you to get one in, and I lost it.
It was something about the southern strain.
Oh, yeah, because when we were down at the Hartley, I mean, we were seeing fish in 76, 78-degree water swimming on mud shoals in 3 foot.
Yep.
I mean, that's nuts. Our fish would have been 18 to 20 foot of water, hunkered deep, nowhere even near that.
Yeah, man, it's just the way they are up here. And I mean, there's some guys that do some guiding down in southern Kentucky. It's Seth Davis and Chris Haley. They have a guide service called the River Rat Guide Service. They fish. They know where to find, you know, they're down in the mountains, man. They're down there where the mountain streams roll out into some of those creeks, and they can fish for them year-round. They did a Kentucky Afield episode. You can look it up on the Kentucky Afield muskie fishing. They took them out in their jet boat in you know, middle of summer, and the water temps were, you know, 72, 73, and they caught a fish and it was fine. It's just some of the streams up closer to me, we don't have mountains, so they just get hot. Sometimes the water's 85, 90 degrees. Ooh. So it's a no go here. But you know, if you want to drive 3 hours south, you can find some stuff. And I don't know enough about the southern strains to for sure feel comfortable fishing some of the lakes when it's that hot. I mean, Cave Run Lake was super hot this year. That's kind of like the southern muskie capital of the world. That's what they call it. That's 2 hours south of me. They're showing surface temps of 90 degrees this year at one point. So that's just hot. I don't know. But like you said, those fish go up shallow, which is the last place you would think they'd be. But
so do we want to talk a little adrenaline and bike ramps?
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah, man.
That's kind of so my actually full time jobs. I run a company called Innovative Dirt Solutions. That's kind of what pays the bills and allows me to go do some musky fishing. But yeah, I've been building bike trails and bike parks for the better part of a decade now, and bike parks have been huge lately. I mean, seems like they're popping up all over. Asphalt pump tracks is one of the things that I do. There's not a whole lot of people in the country that build the asphalt ones. They're pretty nice because you don't have to worry about maintenance or anything. But, yeah, kind of just built trails for a long time and decided to turn it into a business. And it coincides with a nonprofit that I run called Riding Forward that uses wheeled sports to get kids outside and active. So, yeah, sometimes if I can do it and the, you know, the finances are where they need to be, I've built a couple free bike parks, just to give kids a place to ride in the neighborhood. I try to do one community project every year like that, whether it's fixing up an old park or building something new at a park that doesn't have a pump track. I try to do that. But yeah, it's cool to use pretty much just work enough and build enough trail that I can afford to run the nonprofit and do that kind of stuff. I like doing the programming with school programs and kids and teaching them how to ride a bike or work on a bike. That's the cool kind of stuff. So, but yeah, that's kind of what I do during the day. And it just so happens that pretty much for me, that cycle is probably like from March to November is the good time to work on dirt. And then from November to March is a good time to musky fish. So I kind of just make all my money in the summer and then grind it out through the winter.
So you pretty much have a perfect life.
I wouldn't know about that.
What got you into it? Was it riding bikes yourself, or did you like running an excavator or excavator, or what? What got you into it?
I grew up in Petersburg, Kentucky, and there's a guy that lived near me that was like a 9-time national like champion motorcycle racer. So I learned how to ride motorcycles at the age of like 3 or 4 and grew up racing motorcycles pretty much my whole life. And then kind of switched over to bikes and got interested, you know, working on farms and stuff my whole life. I always knew how to run equipment and just kind of picked it up and transferred over to bikes, and it was cool. You know, that was before like mountain biking was real big. So, but yeah, I mean, it's been a cool journey. I'm kind of starting to focus more on the OHV like connectivity stuff, because I really have a big interest in, you know, there's a lot of coal towns in Kentucky that are just don't have any economy, and there's a big push for here in Kentucky to try to like connect towns through coal country, for Jeeps and, you know, four wheelers and bicycles and side by sides, you know, kind of similar to how, Tennessee started to do it with they got some new regulations down there where you can, you know, you can pay a permit for the year and you can actually ride your side by side on some of their roads and things like that. So kind of have a little bit of interest in trying to help that, you know, get started, because I do think it's a good direction for the state to go, as far as more recreation. So.
Yeah, it sounds like the snowmobile trails that are up here and up in New York State. They just go town to town.
Yep, exactly. It's just, you know, connecting them, and there's always a couple diners, a couple bars, a couple, you know, gas stations, whatever, and then you start to see some more like lodging places pop up, and before you know it, like that little tiny place that you went through on your snowmobile has like a little city, you know. And I think that the same could happen here in Kentucky with that kind of stuff. So
that's pretty neat.
Yeah.
And you were saying, your company and your non-for-profit led into you making t-shirts.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of, I guess that's kind of how, you know, that's the other thing with Sully when he had Urban Fly, like he was reaching out and, wanted some branding stuff. I was like, oh man, I got a press and some stuff. If you want me to make you a few shirts or whatever. But yeah, I bought we have a BMX team and a moto team, and, it was just getting so expensive. At one point, I had like 17 riders on my team, and it was like the company that was doing the jerseys for us were wanting like $45 a jersey or whatever to like brand them with all of our logos and our names and stuff. And I just started doing some research, and I was like, man, I can buy some material and a press and a cutter, and I can do them myself. So at that point, it was a no-brainer. I paid for all the equipment in a year, but now I just kind of use it to make one-off shirts for people, small businesses that, you know, maybe can't afford to buy, like, a big run of screen-printed stuff right out of the gate, like, just to get them off the ground. I just have fun with it, making shirts and hats and whatever, really. I mean, it's just nice to have the availability to make a couple stickers, or if I can't do them, I have a couple friends that have graphics companies that can make stickers and things like that. So it's just a good way to, you know, get some marketing stuff done for cheap until you can actually afford to buy a bunch of shirts, you know.
Back when I was in high school, we made t-shirts, like we silk screened them with a ink and a squeegee and a silk screen that we cut the green off and left the silk. Is that how you still do it, or how's it work?
Actually, the process that I have, I actually just have a vinyl cutter, and I use this heat press material that I found it's made more for shirts, like Under Armour shirts. So it's thin and it's flexible. It's not like the old school heat presses that are like real thick and like stick to you.
Yeah.
It's real thin and pliable. And, it kind of limits some of the design. I can't do like 5 and 6 color stuff, but, I like to design things a little more simply anyway. So it ends up working out. But, I just do the design and cut it out and weed it all out like vinyl and press it on a shirt.
But you're cutting it out by hand with an X-Acto knife?
No, I actually have a vinyl plotter.
Like, oh, okay.
CNC plotter. Yeah, the material comes on rolls, and it cuts it all out for me, and then I just kind of weed it out with an X-Acto knife, pull off the negatives, and then press them on.
Hey, what, the quality-wise, I mean, we've had, what's been a couple years now, shirts that you've done from that, and they're holding up just like they were day one.
Man, that's good to hear. Like I said, I'm a really big, like, processes guy. Like, I want to make sure that, like, there's really no reason to, like, not just do a little bit of homework and legwork to get the, like, right process before, you know. Like, I definitely could have just gone to, like, Michael's and bought the cheapest vinyl possible, and it would have, like, cracked off the shirt, and, like, you know, the first time you put it through a high heat session or whatever in the dryer. But, yeah, I mean, once I get into something, I really do, like, dig in both feet first and figure out the best way to accomplish it. So that's cool. That's cool you guys still have those shirts. They got to have quite a few washes on them.
Oh, I tell you what, I wear the thing a lot. So, yeah, it's been through the ringer over the last couple of years. It still looks like day one.
Yeah. You know, the other thing, too, is making sure you get the right material for the shirt. Like, so many people, like, they go cheap on the shirt with, like, just the straight-up cotton, like, jersey shirts or whatever that shrink. And I use tri-blend, like poly stuff all the time because it has that little bit of stretch to it, and like they're more comfortable, but like they don't shrink in the dryer, and they're just better all around material. I'm cool with paying a couple extra bucks per shirt to have a shirt that's gonna last for a couple years. So
for sure,
yeah, it's pay for it once up front or pay for it twice when you have to get it replaced, right?
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, yeah. So. So, yeah, man, it's cool. It's just, you know, something else. I feel like I get my hands into a little bit of everything. I enjoy it, man. I stay busy, and when I get a chance to go do some fishing, I try to fish as hard as I can down here. I'm going to definitely try to get up there for the Beast Tournament next year with you guys, though.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, it's definitely a fun time.
Yeah, I tried to make it happen this year, but couldn't find a partner, and it was short notice, and it was like the timing was just bad because I was like literally getting ready to leave. My anniversary is the 10th of October, so we're literally getting ready to leave to go to Michigan for a week. So it just timing wasn't right, but I'll be up there this year for sure.
So did your wife let you fish while you were in Michigan?
Heck yeah. We got a house on Lake Mitchell. I hauled my boat up, and I snuck out like 3 or 4 mornings out of the week and pike fished. Caught a couple of big smallmouth and some pike. So
speaking of smallies, you have them down your way, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
You fish for them a bit?
Only when they accidentally eat my musky flies. But, no, I shouldn't say that. There's some streams that are real good for wading that we'll do in, like, the summertime. Just because, I mean, catching smallies on a popper is about the most fun you can have, you know? Because that is a day where you can... I'm totally cool with going out and catching 30 or 40 smallmouth in a day on topwater. They don't even have to be big. They're just fun to catch, you know?
And they're all pretty.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they're fun. They all fight real hard. And they're, I mean, heck, man, we got some monster ones down here. It's just not like some of the stuff they got up north. Some of those guys have some big fish up there. But, yeah, I mean, Dale Hollow is the southern end of our state. They're, I think the record came from there. That's a Tennessee and Kentucky lake, and there's tons of good streams that have really big, you know, smallmouth in them. A lot of the musky streams up here have big smallmouth in them. It's just usually if the smallmouth are biting, you need to move because you're in the wrong spot. That's the way it is down here. At least my experiences so far.
What, you don't think they live in the same type of water, or they just don't like being around each other?
I think that they just eat on different, I feel like the water, the water conditions for, like, where smallmouth are eating seems to be a little faster. Some of the rivers and creeks have more undercurrent than you know. It might look like it's okay on top, but when you get into a bunch of smallmouth, it usually typically means that there's more undercurrent than you think. So I typically try to move because our fish are kind of lazy. They like to be in the slack stuff, so.
I hear you on that.
Yeah. They're lazy until they're not lazy. So.
Until they want to destroy a fly.
Yeah.
So is there anything we haven't hit on that you want to hit on, Dave?
Not really. I think for the most part, I was going to talk about something. I was on the Tri-State forum one day, and I saw a guy. He was saying how that he had never caught a fish on a figure eight. And I was just wondering if that was something that, like, is that common for the fish up in your all's area? Or, like, I feel like, 80% of the fish that I've ever caught have been on the figure eight or like right at the boat. Like,
that's not common with me for sure. I think I've landed probably 50% on the eight.
Yeah.
I've never hooked one on or never stuck one on an eight. I've had them eat, but I've never actually, none of the fish I've landed have came on an eight. It works.
I'll tell you, the one thing that, I was taught early on that has helped me a ton, and I see guys that don't musky fish a lot that are fishing a lot of times, like, they always want to see their fly, and I once I got over that fear of not being able to see where my fly was all the time, and like stripping my fly in really deep, my figure eight percentage went up like through the roof, just because, like, whenever you're like stripping back to the boat and you're pulling that fly up at you, the first thing that fish does is it comes up behind it, and then you're in its line of sight, and then it just kind of takes off. But I've gotten into a really good habit of just always putting my fly rod really deep and stripping into the boat deep, and then figure eighting, and I'll bring my fly up close to the surface, but it'll be on my outside turn, like away from the boat, you know. So anything that's coming close to the boat, I always try to keep it deep. And once I started like actually like telling myself I had to do that, I started connecting with a lot more fish in the figure eight, because I think I was just scaring them away starting out. Because it is cool. It looks cool seeing your fly coming back to you. You always want to see a fish come out of nowhere and eat it, but I'd rather have one in the net than see it, you know? So anyone who's having trouble with figure eight stuff, I guess that was a good tip that came into me early on, and took me a while to like get that beat into my brain, but it does seem to work better.
Yeah, it sounds effective for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in your cast, if you're not seeing a fish, how long do you keep the fly in the eight? Are you going two full eights, three eights?
I got a three turn rule. I got three eights. I figure three eighths is good. And that's only because I've done that before, after three times, and then like went to pull my fly out of the water and had a fish literally like almost jump out of the water at it, you know? So like three times is sometimes they just come in low and they stay under the boat and you don't even know they're there, you know? Reading those fish is so hard though. It just takes practice, and it's taken me, you know, I've only been fly fishing for these fish for a couple of years, and I still got a ton to learn, but I'll tell you what, man, the first time I didn't strip set, I trout set the first fish I ever hooked and I lost it. Man, the next fish I strip set, you know, is one discipline takes over at that point. You just got to keep it in your head, like strip set, you know? And it's the same with all the other techniques and tactics. Is just, I had an old timer once tell me that if you don't figure eight three times at least, you're missing 80% of the fish. And I totally agree. I mean, they show up so late sometimes. It's like, I mean, what's a couple extra turns in the figure eight, you know? If it's gonna get you a fish, it's not costing you anything, so.
Yeah, it's like 7 seconds.
Yeah. Like, I know you want to get that fly back out to there because you think it's laid up there next to that, you know, log or whatever, but chances are it followed your fly in low and it's hanging out trying to figure out what it is, and all you got to do is twitch it a different way and it's going to come out of nowhere and destroy it, you know, so.
Now, do you think with the clear water you have down there, you have a tendency to get more fish into the figure eight than, let's say, like, our typical visibility here, maybe 12 inches, and that's at most?
Yeah, I mean, the creek we were fishing on Friday, you could see the bottom of it most of the time. So, I think that they see the fly from farther away, and you'll get a lot more follows that way. I don't know about specifically the figure eight, though. I mean, I think at that point, if you see a fish coming, you just kind of have to read it. If its tail's going crazy, you know it's going to eat. You know, you better speed that figure eight up as fast as you can. And if it's just kind of coming in lazy, you got to do your best to keep it interested and hope that it turns into an eat versus just, you know, a lazy follow a couple of times. But I don't know. I think that the clear water down here when it's this time of year, it kind of hurts you, man. They get so spooked out, it's real hard to get them to eat.
Yeah.
Is the fly game big down there for the muskie?
I think it's getting bigger. It's definitely getting more popular down here. And, I mean, dude, I've caught in some serious flack from people that I originally started fishing with because they were just like, they're all about like not talking about it and this and that. But I mean, like I said, I'm a part of the fly fishing club, and I think it's important for people that are getting into a sport to learn the right way to do things, you know? So talking about musky fly fishing, what it looks like to me is, you know, make sure you got a big net, make sure you got the right tools, make sure you got the right setup, know how to handle the fish, know how to catch and release the fish. It's not, here's where you go, this is the address to go catch them. You know, that part of it, people need to learn that on their own. But I'm super vocal about making sure people know how to handle them, because the last thing I want is for a bunch of guys, you know, I see it all the time. People like get into it, they'll go out and buy a brand new jet boat, brand new everything, and they'll have like a $40 like net for catfish, you know? And it's like, no, you're doing it wrong, you know? Like, that's the most important thing. If you can't spend $200 on a good musky net, like, you're going to mess up, you know? And I think I'll take flack from people all day about, you know, talking about musky fishing me. But at the end of the day, like, that is super important to me. Like you can kill them. You can kill a fish way faster than you think. They're these big, huge fish, and people think that they're just, you know, they're badasses of the water or whatever. And they are, but they're also very, very, I mean, they're fragile, man. I'm sure you guys know it just as much. Like, there's a respect that you earn from those fish as you fish for them. And the last thing I want to see is people coming down fishing them for the first time and catching one and being all excited about it and then releasing it to die, you know?
And what do you think is the best way for someone to learn how to handle fish when it's their first time? Is it going out with someone more experienced, or?
You know, that's a tough call.
Because you learn from doing it, obviously, but.
Yeah. I mean, I still, dude, I mean, unless you've been doing it for 15, 20 years, or you're somebody like, you know, Brad Bowen that's been guiding for forever, like, some of the guys, like, those guys at the River Rat service I was talking about, those guys just reach down into a net and grab the fish like it's a freaking bluegill, you know what I mean? But, like, I'm still, like, sketched out by them. I've had some of the smaller ones cut my hand open with their gills or whatever. I mean, some of those little ones are more feisty than the big ones, you know? But I think if you can find somebody that will let you go out with them and teach you the way of how to do it, that by all means capitalize on it. If not, I mean, YouTube's your friend at this time, you know, in this day and age, you can pretty much find anything you'd ever want to know about handling a fish. But like you said, until you actually physically do it, it's terrifying, you know? Like the first time you get a big fish in the net, I mean, there's no other fish that I've ever caught that is literally looking at you trying to figure out how it can eat you while you're holding it. And that's how they look at you with their eyes, and they just, you can just tell they're just trying to figure out how to F you up the whole time.
I have seen a couple videos online, and I'd like to direct anyone to, if they haven't held these fish, Pete Manna. He always gets a big mount and shows you the proper way to hold a fish with a replica mount.
Yep.
So that's a good one.
Yeah, that's a great one. That's a really great one. There's another guy up in Ontario that does some good ones. What's his name? Scott something? Can't remember his name now. But yeah, Pete Manna is awesome. They do great release stuff. I think it's super important. One of the guys that got me into musky fishing, like, literally, he and I don't even talk anymore, just because he was not about, like, the rod company and, you know, social media and being in the fly club and all that stuff. But like I said, dude, like, I would much rather teach people the right way of doing stuff. Like, the old school guys from the fly club were, like, using treble hooks and stuff, you know? And it's like, that's an old way of doing it. But, yeah, I mean, there's new stuff out there now, you know? These Buford flies and big hooks and big reels and line and sinking line. You don't have to use salmon sink tips and stuff anymore. So just a new game, and it's constantly evolving. So
Have you tried any? Have you tried any flies with trebles or doubles?
Double hooks for sure.
Yeah.
Actually, have a couple game changers with three hooks on them.
Doubles is, I mean, two hooks, like a salmon fly, but you know what I mean?
I've never done that.
Like a frog hook, I should say.
I never have. I just never tried to tie a fly with one.
They're different.
I mean, I was going to say, they have to cast different, but they can't cast any different than, like, a big, like, plastic tail hanging off the back or something, you know?
Exactly.
Just kind of weight, a little different weight, and once you get used to it, it's golden. I mean, the gear guys all use treble hooks, so I just...
A nice thing about it is, with the treble, you can hang it off of, like a split ring, and then you could be, like, a gear guy and clip the hooks, and then just replace the hook.
Yeah. I mean, that's ultimately the key, those split rings, man. If you could get a fly to stay weighted correctly with one, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
I know a lot of guys that tie on their wiggle tails and their dragon tails with split rings so they can replace them and stuff. So just because those things kind of wear out pretty fast. That's something I've been messing with, is just tying on a split ring and having like a hackle tail, a dragon tail, and a wiggle tail that you can, change out on the boat, depending on what you want to throw, So then you kind of have like a little build your own fly kind of setup.
So you're tying those on shanks and then split ringing them on the back?
Yeah, like especially those dragon tails, because I got the Orvis ones seem like they're pretty good, but some of the other ones, like, I mean, like literally like one day of fishing, they're kind of self-destructing on themselves. So I was like, man, this sucks. This is a sweet fly, but the tail's jacked up. And I had a buddy show me how he was tying them on split rings. I'm like, that's a really good idea. And that way it's kind of, yeah, then you can, you can make a back section out of, bucktail and feathers or whatever, It's kind of nice.
Yeah, it's like a Lincoln Logs for flies. Just build them as you go.
Yeah. As long as you don't put a hook on there, because the split rings sometimes, I don't know how much they'd be good. I guess if you used like a heavier one, you could probably put a hook on it, but...
There was a time in my musky career when I tried loop knotting a split ring to the wire leader and then split ringing flies on and off with that.
Nice.
Yeah, it lasted a day.
Yeah, you're like, this is not going to work.
Yeah, the split ring just kept wearing out, and the fly would fall off, and it would slip through the wire.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't the best idea.
Man, that's innovative stuff, though. That's how you figure out what works.
Yeah.
You gotta go through, like, 10 wrong ways before you figure out the right way.
Hey, back to bucktail and what doesn't work. You want me to give you one pro tip?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, don't dye them before you borax them.
I was wondering if that was gonna work or not.
They came out all shriveled up like the guy's hand from Scary Movie 2.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it was all curled up and shriveled up. So it's hard to put them.
I was wondering. Well, I told you that I've bought some from like Hairline before that, like, the hide was like curled in on itself, like, to the point where some of the hair, you couldn't even cut it off because it was just like it was like in a like circle almost.
Yeah.
And I kind of had the speculations on that was probably the reason why they hadn't dried them properly. But thanks for that pro tip, because that was one of the things I was considering trying.
Well, it makes sense though too, because the heat in there is just,
Yeah. I had a guy recently tell me that you don't really have to have it as hot as everyone thinks you do to dye them.
Well, we can attest that about 180 is money. It works.
Really?
That is probably one of the best taps we keep them at.
And I'll tell you, sink water, or as hot as tap water gets, is not money.
No. We've been messing with cold and hot, and cold water die after the run today, as far as I'm concerned. We'll try it a couple more times, but I got that on a really short leash.
Huh.
Not worth it.
Yeah, 180 is a pretty, just below boiling is pretty solid. I did first few batches I tried, I was too hot boiling it. Had a couple come out looking all crazy, like hair soup almost, you know. And, I was like, okay, don't have to have it that hot. So I like to get it up to a boil, get my dye in there, get it stirred up real good, and then I'll bring it back down to about 180. I agree with you 100%, man. That's like the money range for good color.
Yep, that's just about what we found.
Yeah. Awesome.
So, well, hey, we're going to not keep you all evening. Do you want to hit your plugs, give your rod company your not profit and all that stuff?
Yeah, man. The website for the rod company's like still a work in progress, but it is up and live. It's wolfrodco.com. That's wuffrodco.com. And then, if you want to, if anyone ever wants to check out some of the other adventures that I'm getting into, my business, Innovative Dirt Solutions, does some pretty cool bike park building, and ridingforward.org is the nonprofit that I run to kind of give, create a better future through world sports. That's kind of our tagline. So got my hands into a little bit of everything, but I love muskie fishing. I love meeting new folks, and man, the muskie world's been pretty cool. Met a lot of cool dudes. Do an annual trip now to Canada every year to fish with those guys, and yeah, I'll be at the Beast for sure this year. I want to try my hand at some tournament fishing. I've never done it, so
it's a hoot. It's not so much competitive, but it's more fun to be around the guys.
Yeah,
I say that as a guy that's never landed a fish at the Beast in 4 years.
Oh, well, yeah, but you still go every year.
Yeah.
So that's cool. Yeah, I wouldn't be in it for the competition. It'd be more about just the camaraderie. I think it's pretty cool hanging out. I'm gonna do a couple trade shows this year with the rod company, and just keep a lookout. I'll start ramping up social media once I start getting some of my custom musky stuff in. But I think you guys will enjoy the stuff. And yeah, I've been testing it for 18 months. I know it's good, and caught a lot of fish on them. And I only broke one because I was an idiot with my boat. But part of it, man. The warranty's good. The price is right. So if anyone's looking to get into it, definitely check them out.
Well, if you make it up to the Pittsburgh show way, let me know, because I'll be down there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, we appreciate you taking the time out. We know you're busy. It means a lot to us. Thanks, Dave.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me on. You guys have a good night.
Absolutely. You too, buddy.
Yeah.
And we're back. Dave was a great man. Great guy, for sure.
That was fun. That was a good talk.
It was. We're going to cut her a little bit short tonight. Just so everyone knows, a little inside baseball. Mark's not feeling well. And I'm sleepy. So, we're cutting her short.
We still got 75 bucktails sitting in the dryer and need to get borax'd yet.
Yeah, in the dryer out of the washroom for my wife.
And move that back to the garage and get all the pots cleaned outside.
The pots can wait till tomorrow.
At least the table and everything's all washed.
Yeah, and it's put away. So, we're going to cut her short.
Jay's up in New York, so.
Yeah, and hopefully next week we'll have some stories to tell about that. I didn't get any pictures today because my phone's a piece of duty, but I saw some pictures
superior
on your phone.
Operating system, huh?
It's not a superior operating system. It's the it's the oldest phone in the group text.
Yeah, it looks like they got a couple good Browns up there.
Yeah. So, him and our buddy Justin Christofferson and Ryan Evans are up there. Putting on a clinic, it looks like. So, on that note, tonight's show brought to you by Predator Fly Gear. Check them out, predatorflygear.com.
Yep. ARX Hooks, ARXHook.com.
Alsdorf Genetic, go check them out, AlsdorfGenetic.com. Sims Fishing, check them out.
Yeah. Yeti, built for the wild.
And all of these links will be in the show notes tonight. So if anyone wants to check out anything that Dave has his fingers in or anything that we're associated with, go check them out. And next week we're going to have a pretty cool guest. Pogo will be on. And we will catch you then.
Yeah, we'll have some fun doing some musky guide talk.
And a little bit of pike.
Oh, yeah.